Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations with the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 127 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Busy Art Bedke Makes Soft White Wheat His Business, the sequel, about my conversation with the cereal scientist in his home in Moscow, Idaho, where he also serves on the city council. I have a special bond with Bedke. Both of us were Peace Corps volunteers in Africa at around the same time. I taught English, he taught a landlocked people without a fishing tradition to raise fish. Guess who had the tougher job? Regardless where a Peace Corps volunteer served, the commonality among those who were called RPCVs, for Returned Peace Corps Volunteers, serves as an instant bond. As opposed to veterans of the military, there aren't a lot of us RPCVs around. All of us together are about the population of a medium-sized city, say like Spokane, or around 235,000. Although I knew little of agriculture 40 years ago when I was in the Peace Corps, it was a major focus of the organization. I point this out because it still is, and there are certainly opportunities for college graduates of any age, yes, any age, to join the Peace Corps. Although the average age for joining at this point is 28, 7% of volunteers currently serving are over 50. Just saying. Okay, enough of me reminiscing. Bedke isn't a farming kid. He wasn't even a rural kid, but he was a smart kid. He graduated from high school at 16, bought a 1967 Ford LTD, and drove from Washington, D.C. to the University of Idaho, where he received a fisheries degree, particularly useful during that Peace Corps stint. He subsequently signed on to be an observer on a tuna fishing boat to ensure fishery rules were followed. He was not well liked. It was upon his return to Moscow that his life turned from fish to wheat. The first job available was as a technician at the Western Wheat Quality Lab, and as the saying goes, the rest is history. After a few years, he went back to school at WSU and received his graduate degree in cereal chemistry, rising from the rank of a technician to a scientist at the quality lab. He was there for 32 years, retiring in 2011, which is when he set up his company, ADB Wheat Consulting, and began traveling around the world at the behest of the Washington Grain Commission, U.S. Wheat Associates, the U.S. government, and private companies. I spoke with Bedke on March 22, 2019. Our conversation quickly turned to what became known as the Sweet Spot Study, research Bedke conducted investigating the biochemistry behind the practice of blending a high percentage of soft white wheat with hard wheat classes to make a product of equal, if not better, quality at a lower price. I opened this portion of our conversation by asking him to explain what his original research found.
Yeah, in the class of soft white wheat, which is grown primarily here in Washington, it comes in two flavors. It comes in a weak gluten, a very mellow gluten type of wheat that does very well with cookies and cakes. On the other hand, you wind up with a considerable number of varieties in the soft wheat class that produce a stronger gluten type. And in fact, it turns out that the glutenins that form gluten in the wheat are the same as those in hard wheats. So if you blend the appropriate kind of soft wheat, the wheat with the stronger gluten type, with a hard wheat, you wind up with a very synergistic combination of the two. And some of the traits of the soft wheat giving a little more extensibility to dough, a little more mellowness, but still having a strong gluten type, allow for a loaf of bread, for example, to rise to a larger volume while not sacrificing any of the qualities of bread. So you can blend the proper type of soft wheat with a hard wheat up to between 30 and 50% and wind up not only with a superior product in terms of volume and performance and textural attributes that the consumers like, but you can also do it at a cheaper price because soft wheat typically sells at a reduced price compared to hard wheat. So it has a lot of economic advantages all around. And the research bears this out. And I think this is a concept that has a lot of potential application in Asia and down in South and Central America, too, for some of the products that are used there.
Was there any kind of eureka moment as you were doing this work on the sweet spot study?
It kind of revolved around obtaining the varieties of the strong and weak gluten type soft wheats and blending them with the same parent hard flour and looking at what happened. And lo and behold, it's not all the same. You can't just put soft wheat in, soft white, and call it good. It's got to be the right type. And so the eureka moment was looking at the data that resulted from the bake tests on this and going, oh, we have to have the proper kind, the strong gluten type of soft white wheat to blend with the hard wheat. And by doing so, it's kind of, well, son of a gun, look at that. The loaves are very big. The interior structure is good. The texture is great. Wow, look at that.
So I'm going to move out of my order of questions, and we're going to get into the differentiation of the two types of soft white. We think of soft white as a single class, but there are, as you indicated, there are actually two different types of soft white that make up the class. There's called 5 plus 10s and 2 plus 12s, or 5 10s and 2 12s. The 5 10s are L-tan-derived wheats, while the 2 12s, including older varieties like Matson and Stevens, and newer ones like Brundage or Jasper, are 2 12s. All clubs are 2 12s. Now, please explain what these numbers mean and why they are important.
These are the fundamental proteins that go into gluten formation and are responsible for a great deal of gluten performance. So the nomenclature is a holdover from the early 1970s when a scientist named Peter Payne, at the very early stages of wheat protein analysis, decided, well, let's run out some proteins on an electrophoretic gel. And electrophoresis is a way of sieving proteins according to their size. So you put your solubilized proteins on the top of what amounts to something that looks like clear jello, turn on an electrical current, and drag these proteins down through this jello-like matrix. And it separates the proteins out by size. So you have the very large proteins up at the top of the gel because they don't want to move very fast or very far through this, and the small ones sail on through. So our friend Peter Payne did this and took a look at the gel afterwards and noticed that there were differences among different kinds of wheat. And so he needed some kind of way to label these things. So he just started at the top of the gel and started with the first band that he came to. That was number one. And the next one came down as number two, three, four. And he numbered them just on down that way. Well, it turns out that some of the proteins run in pairs. In terms of the 5-10 or the 2-12 types, you never see band number 5, but what it has a 10 with it. And you don't ever see a 10 except that it has a 5 with it. Same thing with the 2 and the 12s. So he started noticing that, gee, these 5-10 pair correspond to the best bread baking type of varieties. And this 2-12 pair seems to be mostly associated with the type of varieties that are used for cakes and cookies. And so people started looking around on all the other varieties, and sure enough, this was holding true. Every single time, 5 plus 10 made good bread, 2 plus 12 made good soft wheat products. Occasionally, you get a 5-10 that would cross over and actually do okay in soft wheat products, but by and large, 5-10 makes nice elastic gluten that works well in yeast-fermented bread products. You get the 2-12 types, and you have something that's more mellow and extensible, and that makes for very nice cakes and cookies. So this is the fundamental difference in gluten formation and gluten quality, is this balance between elasticity and extensibility, and where we apply those different types of gluten strength. And this is why we can get away with blending the soft white wheats with the hard reds. 5-10s like to be mixed with other 5-10s. 2-12s and 5-10s, they really don't like each other much. And tend to interfere with each other during gluten formation, and you have issues there. So that's the fundamental of what's going on. Strong elasticity versus more mellow, extensible type of gluten products.
But customers don't have any choice in what they get because everything is funneled down to Portland, and it's a combination of 510s and 212s, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that causes a lot of consternation on the other side of the Pacific Ocean when a cargo ship full of this random mixture of strong and weak gluten types arrives, and what you find in one boat is not going to be the same as what you find in the next boat, and this introduces variation to the mills and bakeries, to our customers on the far side of the Pacific Ocean. They hate variation, and we're throwing the strong and weak gluten types together in a random mixture, and that introduces variation to them, and it's very difficult to deal with. They can deal with it, they just don't like it, and they would prefer to have something much more consistent.
As farmers in Eastern Washington, do we need to pay attention to the quantity of 510s and 212s that we grow? And what might happen if we shifted primarily to one or the other? Let's say, for instance, all of a sudden we're growing predominantly 212s. I mean, would that be an advantage or would that be a disadvantage?
That's another one of those quality things. It depends on who you ask. So it would not be good to go completely one way or another. I think somewhere between 30 and 40% of the stronger gluten types in soft white wheat is advantageous. That can be used for production of things like crackers and some other specialty products, maybe some croissant doughs, things like that, where you need some gluten strength in your soft white wheat, but you want to maintain the other soft white attributes. So having the 510 there is good for that. Having the 212s would delight the Japanese because it makes excellent sponge cakes, excellent cookies, delicate confectionaries of all kinds. But going all one way or the other would exclude us from certain potential markets. And if we could segregate the strong and the weak gluten types away from each other, we could satisfy a lot of consumer needs and go a long ways towards reducing variation in cargoes going across the ocean. And there is a lot of interest in Asia in finding the stronger soft white gluten types for use in some of the products that they need over there, dumpling skins, for example.
So, Art, if you were in charge, would you mandate that publications like the Seed Buying Guide or the Preferred Variety Brochure list soft white varieties by their 212 or 510 distinctions?
I think that would be counterproductive until the marketing system can accommodate segregation of the two, at least, you know, maybe up to a 80% segregation between the two types. I would advocate use of the protein designations in the variety release area so we know what it is we're dealing with, and being able to put the test results more in a context. So at variety release, yes, but until the marketing system can accommodate segregation of the two types to a substantial extent, I think it would be a waste of time and it would be a disservice to our customer by essentially promising something we can't deliver.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So in terms of blending, is there more to know or do we pretty much understand how the interaction works when we're blending soft white with the hard wheat classes?
Oh, there's always more to know. This study was kind of the first swipe at it that indicated that, yes, there is feasibility. But gluten is a complicated polymer. It consists of thousands of different proteins and some carbohydrates that have all joined together to form this matrix. So the 510 plus 212 thing describes a lot of the functionality, but probably 65%, maybe two-thirds of the variation is explained by that. The rest of it is explained by some of the other proteins that coexist in the gluten formation. So there's a lot more subtlety that's involved here that we don't yet understand, which is always an issue with wheat because it's so bloody complicated. There's always going to be stuff we don't understand about it. And there's room for more work and research on this.
And there was an initial surge of interest, and U.S. Wheat Associates even hired a consultant in South America to go to mills. Where do we stand now?
We stand kind of where we were. The biggest impediment to providing the functionality that mills and bakeries might like to see in terms of this soft white versus hard red blending and issues like that that would decrease cost to the mills, the bakeries, and potentially the consumers while providing a better product is somewhat stymied by our own export and grading system. The export and transportation system has indicated that they are unable to accommodate a scheme like this in the current conditions because they believe that it would necessitate the construction of a lot more grain bins and storage units and make their lives more difficult. So they believe that the current scheme is as good as it's going to get, absent economic incentive to go forth and construct new facilities, which may or may not be necessary. But just to segregate the two types would require some mental effort that so far no one has been willing to undertake.
Interesting. At one point, you were going to look into including club wheat along with soft white in blends. Did you ever do that research?
Oh, yeah, I did. I did do that research, sticking strictly within the gluten-forming protein classification of the 212 types, the mellow, extensible gluten types, blending some of the soft whites with club. To take a running start at this, back in the late 1950s, club wheat was the majority of the grain grown in Washington. Probably 80% of the crop was club wheat. And then in comes stripe rust. And that preferentially killed off club wheat. Club wheat had no resistance to it and was essentially slaughtered. So suddenly, in a 2 or 3 year period, Washington swung from 80% club wheat to 80% soft white. Well, soft white has a whole different characteristic than club wheat when it comes to end uses, especially in Japanese sponge cakes. The Japanese were not pleased with this agronomic development. So they insisted that they wanted as much club wheat as possible still in the shipments going over there to them. And hence the construction of the market class Western White, which is anywhere from 10 to 90% club wheat blended with soft white, or the other way around, 10% soft white up to 90% club. So in there, anywhere in there is actually Western White, and it typically runs around a 20% blend, which, gee, let's think about it. If club wheat is 20% of the crop, why not have 20%? So I undertook a study where I blended club wheats with soft whites and took a look at how they performed in cookie and cake production. And son of a gun, if 20% isn't just about optimum, anywhere from 20% up of club wheat blended with soft wheat makes the best sponge cakes. Lo and behold. But to really affect increased quality in cookie production or some of the other confections, it ranges anywhere from 40 to 60% club wheat blended with soft white before you see a really big effect that can be measured. So, yeah, it does work.
You know that Japan thinks of club wheat as medicine. You put a little bit in to fix the hole. But I don't think there are any buyers of club wheat domestically. As you indicated, at one time before the introduction of Gaines wheat, a soft white, in 1960, club was the predominant wheat grown in the Northwest. You know, why doesn't it get used domestically at all?
Tradition. Because the U.S. grain industry started from about Minneapolis, Kansas City, going east. So that's where all of the domestic large mills were set up, all of the domestic large bakeries. And mills and bakeries don't like dragging their grain and flour around over great distances. They like getting it as close to local as they can because it minimizes shipping costs. So the industry was set up back there, and club wheat grows almost 100% in the state of Washington. Well, we don't have a lot of mills or bakeries out here on the West Coast. So, frankly, we export the majority of our highest quality grain. Soft white beats the pants off of soft red when it comes to producing a lot of products. Club wheat, even better for confections, cakes, cookies. And where does it go? It goes off to the Pacific Rim and elsewhere. And because the U.S. industry is not set up to take advantage of our highest quality grain, we send it off to the overseas guys. And here in the U.S., we use a much more mediocre soft red.
There you go. And what are we going to do about the next generation of cereal scientists? I mean, is there a next generation of cereal scientists?
There really isn't. There's an enormous gap. There are a few programs here in the U.S., like Kansas State or North Dakota State, that have cereal science programs, but they're fundamentally devoted to their local products, which would be hard red winter and hard red spring wheats. There aren't any that are devoted to soft red winter, soft white winter, club wheat, any of those other products that represent a huge part of the market. And I fear that there aren't a lot of traditional cereal chemists out there who have broad-based experience and in-depth knowledge of the genetics and the biochemistry of wheat and how best to take advantage of it. And there's going to be problems after some of us old guys retire or move on to the great beyond of identifying and taking advantage of wheat quality. Pacific Northwest doesn't have a lot going for it when it comes to marketing wheat except for quality. And so we have to pay attention to quality, but who's going to be doing the paying attention to if there aren't a whole lot of people with this depth of experience and knowledge to help out the process? We're run the risk of becoming stagnant and assuming that the same old is good enough for the future. And the same old is not good enough for the future at all.
Okay, here's an off-the-wall question. As a cereal chemist, do you have any agronomic advice for farmers, something that would decrease costs or increase the value of their crop in the field?
If I were growing something in the hard red, I'd be taking a real look at soil analysis and especially making sure you have enough sulfur in the soil as part of the fertilizer package, because sulfur is the element that is intrinsically involved with good gluten formation. You need to have the sulfur in there to be able to make the cross-linking areas available for gluten. So if you're making hard wheat and you want to have good gluten quality and good gluten amounts, watch out for the soil chemistry and take a look at what's going on in there. In the soft white area, you need the old farmer's almanac, I guess, because you don't want to over-fertilize soft white wheat. You want to maintain lower protein content and reduced amounts of gluten. And more rainfall, more water per plant means more starch, less protein, and a higher quality product. So I'm not sure how you determine that one ahead of time. But yeah, trying to fertilize and get the right amount of water in the soil to help your crop along if you're doing soft white, very advantageous too.
Do you have any thoughts on the National Wheat Yield Contest that is being run across the United States?
I think it's a wonderful public relations approach. How many bushels can we get? And it certainly puts the growers in mind of agronomic management to maximize their yields. It gets them thinking about that. On the other hand, it could have a downside in that people start going for, as we discussed with the Afghan thing, finding wheat that grows like a weed and produces like crazy but is utterly useless for anything else. So I think having the national yield contest would be great, especially if they could couple it to what's the quality of your grain afterwards and giving equal weight to that aspect.
If anybody knows how important quality is in wheat, it's Art Bethke. Perhaps the National Wheat Foundation ought to hire him to be one of the quality referees on the Wheat Yield Contest. By the way, if you haven't already listened to episode 120, you really should. It's entitled, The National Wheat Yield Contest Stumbles, But Gets Up Again. Steve Yale,
who directs the contest, does a great job of answering difficult questions and doesn't beat around the bush when it comes to taking responsibility for a quality misstep. All right, everybody, hope you enjoyed the show. For those of you who find out about each week's episode on the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page, please like the posts. It does my heart good to see those little thumbs up. Then join me here again next week for another episode of Weed All About It!
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. Always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.